This is Casey Dobson, and you're listening to CJRU 1280 AM here in Toronto. This story is part of the Local Journalism Initiative. Bubbles have become the norm for sports leagues as North America continues to struggle to get COVID-19 under control. And this makes sense given the high transmission rates of the virus. After the NWHL had to halt their 2020 season before crowning a champion, a bubble seems like the most logical and potentially only path for a 2021 season. On November 25th, 2020, the league made it official when they decided that their sixth season would happen in a limited two-week bubble format in Lake Placid. Their release stated that the bubble would be played in the Herb Brooks Arena, the same rink that saw the hockey action during the 1980 Winter Olympic Games. And it was additionally revealed that the bubble format was chosen due to a continued uncertainty and safety issues associated with the pandemic. A new concern the league had to deal with was the cross-border travel presented by the addition of the Toronto Six. So, what is a bubble? Simply put, a bubble is a campus-like environment in which the league operates until a winner is crowned. The basis for how these have worked for leagues like the NWSL or the WNBA is that nobody who isn't essential to the games being played is allowed in, and those who are essential are strongly discouraged from leaving. If they do leave, there are extensive protocols required before they can rejoin the team. By the numbers, this model has worked like a charm up until this point. For example, the NWSL executed a month-long bubble in Utah for their Challenge Cup without having a single positive test result. It should be noted that the Orlando Pride pulled out of the tournament prior to leaving for Utah because of an outbreak within the squad. We can also look at the MLS as a successful example of a league working in a bubble, despite the early stumbles of having two teams withdraw in Dallas and Nashville because of their overwhelming number of cases. But once those teams left, the MLS didn't see a positive test result between July 10th all the way up until the end of the tournament. The MLS's back tournament success was even more impressive when you consider the fact that it unfolded in one of the biggest hotspots for the virus, Florida. So, how do leagues do it? This aspect of past bubbles should have been of particular interest to the NWHL as it would have allowed them to derive a blueprint for their own. Granted, we know that the league was operating with far less capital than the rest of the sports world, something Cheyenne D'Arcangelo understands all too well.
Obviously, they had a lot more money that went into theirs, but hey, this is a huge step for women's hockey to even do that. Mm-hmm. I don't think anyone would have even thought that was going to happen, to be honest. So,
for the sake of consistency across sports, let's look at the NHL's Toronto/Edmonton bubbles and what allowed them to be successful. The league released a 47-page document explaining everything from testing policies, guest rules, and in-game hygiene procedures. So to say that they had thought of everything would be an understatement. The first step taken by the league, other than limiting city blocks around the hotel and arena compounds, was limiting the travel parties for each team to 52 people. Each person was assigned a group from 1 to 4, with 1 being vital to games being played, think players, coaches, Zamboni drivers, and 4 being not required for games. These rankings would determine how much contact the individual would be permitted to have with the rest of the team. From a testing standpoint, the league stated that there would be regular testing of everyone from players to coaches to hotel housekeepers and bartenders. Should a test come back positive, the individual would need to return 2 consecutive negative tests before they would be allowed out of self-isolation. Contact tracing investigations would begin immediately following the uncovering of a positive result. Each team would be confined to their own floor in the hotel, and even there, they would have to social distance and wear masks when not in their individual rooms. And if you were concerned about players from different teams being in elevators and the transmission risks associated with that, don't worry, the NHL had a solution. They banned talking in elevators. Dining was confined to be buffet-style, with plexiglass separating players from servers, with non-contact room service options also available. The in-game hygiene measures included the obvious of no sharing of water bottles, with bottles having to be labeled and separated, but it also took towels into account, explicitly stating that each team needed to have a minimum of 100 clean towels behind the bench, and those could also not be shared across players. The NHL and all other leagues who operated successful bubbles had a 48-hour required quarantine upon arrival to the bubble and required athletes to have 2 negative test results after arriving before they were allowed to leave their rooms. Knowing all of this and seeing how well it worked, the NWHL had the framework to operate their own successful bubble. Their bubble was built on the agreement with Yale University to provide saliva-based COVID-19 testing for players and staff, similar to the model operated by the NBA. But the women's hockey bubble was not successful. The league announcing the suspension of their season on the eve of the playoffs. The press release cited safety concerns after the most recent batch of test results came back positive. Up until this point, the bubble had already seen two teams withdraw. The Metropolitan Riveters were removed from the tournament after surpassing the league's agreed-upon threshold for active positive cases at 10. The Connecticut Whale had forfeited their final game and then bowed out. While their decision was not confirmed to be because of positive cases, an official statement from the team pointed to them choosing to protect their players' physical and mental well-being. I asked six forward D'Arcangelo about how she felt after the two opposing teams had withdrawn from action.
Obviously, there was things going on, like medical things and different reasons why teams, you know, had to step out and things like that. So obviously, at that point, it was just I don't think it was ever if, oh, we're going to choose to step out. And I don't think necessarily those teams as well. It's more just the fact with like COVID protocols and things like that going on that, unfortunately, you know, if things arise, you would have no other option but to have to be sort of disqualified from the tournament at that point, right? So it was more just shocking or like disappointment, because obviously you want all teams competing. You know, it just changes the scene. You don't want one or two teams out, and then obviously it's still fun to be able to finish that way, but at the same time you want to be able to, you know, play everybody and make it to the end, that sort of thing.
But how did a structure that had a track record of success fail so badly? The answer to this lies in the fact that the NWHL bubble wasn't exactly a bubble. And there is perhaps nothing as emblematic of this as the evolution of the language used by league personnel when referring to the tournament format. When the initial announcement was made, it was referred to as a bubble. Shortly after that, league officials began referring to it as a modified bubble. By the time suspension of play was announced, league commissioner Tyler Tomina was calling it a restricted access environment. It all started with the arrival policies, where other leagues enforced the 48-hour quarantine, as well as needing two negative tests for the individual to exit self-isolation. The NWHL was operating under vastly different rules. Instead of the proven system, the league was requiring a negative test within 72 hours of leaving for the tournament, as well as one negative test on arrival. No requirement for the two consecutive negatives, nor for the isolation period. Not only did this aspect make it nearly impossible to keep tabs on who could be potentially bringing in the virus, the risks were compounded by the fact that the games had started before many players were able to be retested. And even though the league quickly pivoted to be operating on a daily testing schedule, there was nothing to be done to reverse the initial exposure. According to reports, teams were all staying in different hotels that were open to the public, thus eliminating any control the league could have had over their athlete circumstances when not on the ice. And despite Tamina's statement about the players' movements being restricted from room to rink, a post from the Buffalo Butte's Instagram account showed players out exploring the town, squashing the league's stance of limiting the whereabouts of those involved with the tournament. Add to all of this the fact that hockey is one of the worst sports to be played during a pandemic because of the conditions in which it is played. According to Teresa Chapel Magruder, an epidemiologist, the cold indoor rinks provide an environment in which the virus lives longer. The current plan is for the season to resume at some point, though no plans for that have been made public as of yet. Despite not having crowned a winner in Lake Placid, Tamina sees the bubble as a success. While many will debate her on that, one thing that isn't up for debate would be the success of the Toronto Six. At the time of suspension, the Six had the league's best record with 4 wins, 1 loss, and 1 overtime loss, thanks in no small part to their high-octane offense. While the team got off to a slow start, losing 3-0 to the Riveters despite firing 40 shots on net in their first ever game, here's what D'Arcangelo had to say about the feeling going into that first game.
Yeah, geez, I think it was just super exciting, honestly. I know for myself, I hadn't played a game in quite a while. I don't even know how many days it was, but it felt like, you know, forever, like being a part of a team, at least to like a normal season. Obviously it wasn't, but it was like, hey, this is like tournament hockey where, you know, we're part of the Six and you're having the same girls on your line, like right on your team. And you get to play 6 games or more, depending on how you do that kind of thing. So it was just honestly a lot of excitement. And I think that kind of showed in our first game, to be honest. We had a lot of people who, it was their first season playing professional hockey as well. So I think just for everybody gripping their sticks tight, because we're like, woo, we finally get to play a game. But yeah, it was awesome.
Shortly after notching their first game in franchise history, the Six notched their first ever shootout loss. This may be one somewhat wiped from the record books, as the team was up 5-1 before falling to the Minnesota Whitecaps in the dreaded shootout. The team finally got their first win in their third game thanks to a third period comeback against the Boston Pride. The expansion side scored 2 goals in 2 minutes in the final frame to get themselves the win.
Unable to keep it in the zone. Boston has not had almost any opportunity in their attacking zone. Centering pass was deflected in! Toronto takes the lead! What a deflection there for the Six!
The team followed that up with 3 convincing wins, including an emphatic 6-0 win over the Whale.
For the Toronto Six, they have won 4 games in a row, and they are your number one seed in the Isabel Cup playoffs. 6-0 winners tonight over the Connecticut Whale.
When all ended up being said and done, the Six were, somewhat surprisingly, atop the league and set to take on the Buffalo Buttes in semifinal action. When and where that game will hopefully be played remains to be seen, but it is clear that the NWHL wants to have a 2021 Isabel Cup champion. This is Casey Dobson, and you've been listening to CJRU 1280 AM in Toronto. The story is part of the Local Journalism Initiative, funded by the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Stay tuned for our next episode, where we'll look at the history of media with regards to women's sports, including a breakdown of the Barstool situation. Thanks for listening.